This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we're joined by a space and aviation reporter who helps us understand the current state of the aviation industry and where it all leads. We also bring you an inside look at the process for producing an article in a popular aviation magazine. We all read the stories. This is about how that story is created by an aviation journalist. Our next episode is episode 600, and to celebrate that, we want to put you on the show. We'll use Zoom, but we'll take some precautions to help mitigate against the Zoom bombing that has been going on. So if you'd like to join us on April 20th, 2020, at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, send an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com with the subject Episode 600. We'll reply with the Zoom meeting ID and the password. We hope to see you then. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 599 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hi, David.
Hello, everyone. Hopefully everyone's staying safe and home. Looking forward to a very long and interesting conversation tonight. So looking forward to that.
Yeah. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI of the year, and he's also an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Dun, 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 dun. Welcome to day 36 of the hostage crisis. Does it start to feel like the old Ted Koppel nightline from the late 1970s, where just one day after another, there's another update on the hostage crisis? I mean, it just kind of feels like we're living like Groundhog Day. It feels like we're living the same day over and over again. So anyway, nice to see you folks all again. And just want to let you know I'm alive and well and complaining just for that. not for any good reason, just because
you can.
Exactly.
Our guest this episode is Tom Risen, space and aviation reporter in Washington, D.C. Tom was our guest back in episode 571, and he's been covering the latest news and writing analysis about how airlines and aerospace manufacturers are adapting to the quarantine measures. And he joins us this episode to help us navigate through these topics. Tom is co-authoring a book about government oversight. He is the web editor and reporter for Future Flight News. And Tom was formerly technology and business reporter at U.S. News and World Report and a staff reporter for Aerospace America. Tom, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's a lot of fun last time, and I can tell you about all the coronavirus crazy here in Washington.
Oh, yes, yes. Unfortunately. Boy, you know, it seems to be sort of the single topic these days for almost everything, and especially for aviation, of course. But a couple of announcements first. Last week, we had Launchpad Marzari introduce you to this concept of the worst, baddest aviation movie of all time, and he has a little update on that.
Hey, Max. The response to our bad movies has been coming in pretty good. And in fact, we're going to extend the deadline for submitting your good reason why this is a bad aviation movie until midnight, April 22nd, at which time we'll pick the five best examples of bad aviation movies and put them on our Slack page for our Slack listeners to vote. Then we'll pick the winner and announce it on our show on April 27th. And reminder that our winner gets to go outside his house and shake the hand of a real aviator or some other cool prize that we come up with. To recap the rules, we're looking for bad aviation movies, which weren't intended to be bad. They just came out that way. Send your submission to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, subject line bad movies. All right, Max, back to you.
All right. Thanks, Launchpad. All right, let's jump right into the aviation news from the past week. Is everybody ready?
Ready from the West.
Let's do it.
Ready.
All right. We can start out Kansas.com. Article, Boeing to restart limited local work on jets. And Boeing just recently ceased production, but there's an announcement that at least some of the employees that have been impacted by the shutdown are happy to hear, I think. Max, what do we see here?
Well, good news is we are headed back to work. At least some of the people at Boeing are headed back to work. Not all of them by any stretch, actually less than 10% of them. But of the 30,000 employees idle at the shutdown, Boeing's recalling about 2,500 of them. And it looks like they'll be working mostly on some of the defense programs, which is not too much of a surprise because the demand for commercial aircraft right now is, if not zero, probably negative. I think people would probably like to send some of their airplanes back at this point in time. But yeah, some of the programs like the Navy's P-8 anti-sub aircraft and the KC-46 tanker, those apparently are going to get some people back on the line working on them.
And also we understand some of the maintenance functions for the 737 MAX jets that are currently being stored at Moses Lake. So a little bit of commercial action as well. But yeah, that's 2,500 employees recalled out of the 30,000. That leaves a lot of people still out.
One of the takeaways I think from this is that if you're getting money from the government, then that is more stable. That may be a stable source of revenue because the government wants its military products.
Yes, it's often a good strategy for a company that could serve both markets, commercial and military, to serve both of them because of the fact that in a case like this, you see, where one might be in a down cycle and the other may not be. And so it provides at least some degree of stability from a business operations standpoint.
Yeah, like the airlines that fly soldiers for the military might get some of those flights to keep going. So that's some kind of revenue they might be able to count on.
Right. And I'm sure they're very eager. The airlines are very eager to be able to take advantage of whatever revenue they can right now. We'll talk about that in a few minutes with respect to cargo. But Boeing isn't the only one that's cut production. Airbus has cut its production, they announced, by about a third, which is pretty substantial. The airlines are suspending orders.
I was kind of surprised at the report here that Airbus had delivered 122 planes in the first quarter, but that 60 of them remained undelivered. That's pretty unusual. Generally, you know, when you deliver an aircraft, it stays delivered. But here they're saying essentially half of what they delivered in the first 3 months, you know, wasn't taken up by the airline. So, of course, a couple possibilities. One might just be the logistics of, hey, it's not a good time for us to send people out to go get those aircraft. But on the other hand, you know, we didn't really get deeply into this until early to mid-March. And yet the first quarter, you had a couple of months, 2.5 months to take those airplanes, and yet somehow half of them in 3 months didn't get delivered. So it sounds to me like, you know, the airlines are purposely slowing the flow of new aircraft into their fleet.
Which isn't surprising. I mean, they're barely flying, it seems, and accepting additional aircraft deliveries is something that they just as soon avoid, I think. But I'm sure that there are penalties and storage fees in the case of the undelivered Airbus aircraft or who knows what. It could get pretty complicated. But something that's not complicated, in fact, is really simple, is the computers on the 737 MAX. And an interesting piece in The Verge titled "The Ancient Computers in the Boeing 737 MAX Are Holding Up a Fix." That jet has two independent flight control computers, which I think we've talked about in the past with respect to one being compared to the other to find difficulties or discrepancies. But turns out these are not very current technology computers.
Now, I was really stunned when I read this article. They say that the computers in the 737s that are being shipped today are built on a processor made by Collins Aerospace, first built in 1996. And the computer geeks will understand the import of this. They are single-core 16-bit processors. I mean, holy cow. You know, we moved to 64-bit processors on just about everything decades ago. So it's, to me, it's shocking. It's somewhat reminiscent of the kind of computer power that they had in the space shuttle and before that, you know, in Apollo. And the problem with all of those kinds of programs is you end up with ancient, you know, computing equipment because it's so hard to certify new stuff on the fly. In other words, you just don't have time to kind of take down the old stuff and create something totally new and put it in there. So these are vastly underpowered computers by any standard whatsoever. And of course, with the 737 Max, I think most people know at this point that because of the newer, heavier engines, rather than redesigning the hardware, they decided to solve the problem in software, which only put an additional burden on these very rudimentary type computers. Well, of course, Boeing submitted a software fix to the FAA last summer, but in the process, it was revealed that there were other problems in the code, specifically that they were vulnerable to single-bit errors. Now, single-bit errors are caused essentially by kind of random problems in the RAM memory chips, where as they get older, there tends to be a little bit of leakage of current in them. And sometimes you'll get one bit that flips from a 0 to a 1 or a 1 to a 0. And the way you solve that in most systems, which, by the way, is easier to do with 64-bit computers, is you have error correction built in. A lot more difficult to build an error correction to 16-bit computers. But get this, when they found these single-bit errors, they found that they could disable the entire control system. They could throw the airplane into an uncommanded dive. All of these things are bad. And so I think what this tells us is that, the problems are probably a little deeper than any of us imagined. And it's like a novel where there seems like there's a new chapter every few weeks. It just keeps getting, deeper and deeper. So,
but are they Y2K compliant?
Yeah, I suspect they were. I suspect they fixed that problem a long time ago.
You know, the flip side is that these are, other than this, you know, this bit flipping issue, I mean, they're old and reliable. The newer computers that are more complex introduce their own kinds of error possibilities, failure vectors that can take place. So it goes, it kind of goes both ways. Although, obviously, one of the big reasons probably that Boeing stuck with them is because why change them if they work so well on the 737 NGs, and the cost of changing the compute system. But old doesn't necessarily mean bad. There is a school system in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And they actually run the HVAC system for 19 schools on a Commodore Amiga that was set up in the early 1980s. And it still runs. If it breaks, they're kind of screwed, but it still runs and it works perfectly. It is kind of a complicated system because it sends out commands to the schools over shortwave radio frequencies, if you can believe that. And some of those frequencies are now used by maintenance worker walkie-talkies, so that can cause some interference. But I just thought that was kind of an amusing story. I remembered that from years ago, and I had to search to get the facts of the story. But there's an argument for keep it simple.
Yeah, I remember the Commodore PET computer, I believe. Was it? I think they made that. It was about 77 or something like that. I don't remember the Amiga, but yeah, it's amazing. That's that should be in a museum at this point.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think they're actually looking at replacing it. And, to kind of relate it more solidly back to the Boeing case with their flight control computers, But I think the school system is looking at replacing it with something more modern, and it's going to cost them $2 million. You could keep the Amiga for free until it breaks.
Yeah, I think a better strategy would be rob the museum, steal their Amiga.
Yeah.
That way you have a backup.
Yeah, yeah. All right. One thing that, of course, has been in the news a lot lately is about the CARE Act that was passed in the United States. CNBC reports Treasury Department says larger airlines need to compensate taxpayers for coronavirus aid as talks drag on. So why does the Treasury Department have anything to say about the aid authorized by Congress? Well, Congress approved $25 billion in grants for U.S. passenger carriers, $4 billion for cargo airlines, $3 billion for airline contractors. And there are some conditions to receive this aid. For example, airlines must not furlough employees or cut their pay rates through September 30th, 2020. The Treasury Department said that they would not require applicants who are seeking less than $100 million to provide this compensation to taxpayers, but those with greater numbers would have to do that. Officials said that the compensation could include things like stock warrants or other financial instruments, but this thing is kind of tied up, I guess, in conversations about what does all this mean?
Well, there's been a lot of pushback from the trade associations for the different airlines. And one of the concerns was providing equity. Like you said, they wanted to make sure that they would have some kind of collateral to make sure that they would pay them back or some kind of, because Treasury has the power to revoke the money if they break the conditions. The conditions include you can't spend it on their stock buybacks. They can't furlough employees. They can't cut their pay rate, you know, their benefits. And there's minimum service requirements like, okay, you're not going to fly. You have to fly a certain amount of flights, like for essential air service. You know, the Department of Transportation mandates that in places like Alaska or Hawaii, you know, places that need air travel for cargo or passenger flight, that they have to keep flying a minimum service network. So there's been all these conditions that people have been pushing back on, especially the smaller carriers. Like the Treasury said that they've received at least 230 applications for a pot of $25 billion. And I think the six large that they mentioned that the 12 largest bids are the ones that they're working on. So that's definitely American, Delta, United, Southwest, you know, the big ones. And the smaller regional, like the average claim is $10 million, less than $10 million. But there are about 12 of them that are asking for more than $100 million for their wage grants to pay their workers through the end of September. So the silver lining here is that once they do cut the checks, the smaller regional carriers are going to get what they asked for. They're not going to have to fly as many routes. They will not have to provide equity because they argued that they can't. I don't know what – it's not a very good argument that they made. They said they can't get debt, that not all of them are publicly traded. But this was kind of rushed, that they didn't coordinate with the airlines to tailor it for their needs and tailor it for the reality of their businesses that they're facing, because they're getting almost no revenue right now. And they need this money right away. But you had to make sure that it's going to have some strings attached and that Treasury will have some kind of control over it. But it happened so quickly that they didn't really consult with the industry about how it should work. So they keep adjusting it.
Yeah, and one of the adjustments, I think, was that Congress awarded $25 billion in immediate cash, but Treasury said they're only going to award $17.5 billion of that in cash grants, and the others were going to be, I believe, loans. So it almost seems like Treasury got a little bit more restrictive than Congress had intended.
Well, you have to remember that there is a separate pool of money in addition, because this is payroll grants that goes directly to the workers that will, you know, through September. There is another pot of money, you know, because this is $50 billion combined. So on top of the money, there is another $25 billion for these carriers in loans. So the payroll grants goes directly to the workers. And if they really need money to keep the business going, then they can ask for loans. And that hasn't even happened yet. So after this is going to be, that'll be even more complicated, because we're talking about giving money to the company instead of money to pay the wages for the workers. they haven't issued guidance about that yet. They're still trying to get through this step. And they hope, the Treasury put out a notice today, they hope that people will start to get their checks this week or next week. We'll see how that works out.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask, because I wonder how long this is going to drag out, because you can imagine that, that some of the negotiations could be tough. And if Treasury is really adamant about what they want, airlines are going to be faced to either walking away or, you know, having to give up more than they expect. And those negotiations could drag out over, you know, just too much time.
There was it was mentioned in some news reports today that the government could end up owning 3% of American Airlines. So they might want equity for this if they can't. You know, they're still working. This is very much, you know, in flux. They're still working out the details. And the loans, like I mentioned, that's a separate pot of money they haven't even started to discuss yet.
This seems like one of those kind of classic cases of speed versus accuracy. What do you want the trade-off to be? There was certainly a lot of pressure to or on Congress to get this through quickly. And you can't create something as complex as this quickly, if you take the time to really understand the implications, the unintended consequences, and all that stuff, you know, it take months at minimum. So I don't know. I think you have to kind of go into this realizing that it's going to be imperfect, and in some ways, you just have to plow ahead.
Yeah, I mean, people were pushing Congress to get the money through as quickly as possible. We should be almost grateful that they did debate it the way that they did, because even now, you know, this shows that just how little detail there is. We should be thankful that there is any detail at all.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I don't think it'd be fair to say that, even though it's a little messy right now, I don't think it'd be fair to say that Congress did a bad job of it. I think they did the absolute. Well, I'm an absolute, but they did, you know, they did the best job they could.
Government work.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, they were quick, and how often can you say that about Congress?
Yeah, but others are upset, and also from CNBC, there's a piece, quote, "This will lead to airline bankruptcies," and that from our flight attendant union furious with Treasury bailout offers. And this comes from Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants, that union. She was our guest in episode 545. And she stated that this will lead to airline bankruptcies. The Treasury Department is destabilizing the industry, not helping save it. And I think the way she's looking at this is that the Treasury Department has decided that 30% of each cash grant offer is a low-interest loan payable to the federal government. So it's got to be repaid. And she's thinking that if it's a loan, not every airline will necessarily agree to a loan. And so the money that's supposed to go to the employees may, in fact, not.
Yeah, she was arguing in favor of the loan. Like this, again, the loans are a separate pool of money, like the $25 billion that is explicitly loans. But she wanted the payroll grants pool of money to be very simple, just go to the workers.
Clean and simple. But yeah, the CARES Act, and if you're not familiar with it, it's the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. And according to CNBC, it did give the Treasury Secretary the ability to set the terms and conditions for the cash grants. So it gave the Treasury Secretary some leeway to establish those things.
Did you ever wonder whose job it is in Washington to come up with the acronyms for all these bills that have passed? I mean, how do you get that job? I mean, it seems to me that when we were young, you know, the name of an act was the name of the act. Somewhere along the line, they started getting cute, and it's like every act now needs a catchy acronym. So I'm still wondering, who is that person that makes up these names?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Sometimes they seem kind of forced. At other times, they're treated, the act name is treated as a marketing term almost. Case in point, the Patriot Act. How could you be against the Patriot Act? It's called the Patriot Act.
Yep.
Of course, it includes some things that no patriot would ever agree to. But
and who would want to vote against a CARES Act? I mean,
yeah, we're caring because we care.
I think you're right. There probably is something to that.
Yes, yes. Now, we talked about some of the pilots, some of the airline pilots and flight attendants being offered packages, voluntary leave or early retirement. And Dallas News has an item, nearly 13,500 American Airlines pilots and flight attendants agree to voluntary leave or early retirement. Now, that's more than a third of the American Airlines pilots and flight attendants. Voluntary leave or retirement would occur in April or May.
Yeah, one thing to remember about this is that the airlines are coming off of a period of great growth. So most of the airlines do have cash on hand. You know, they're burning through tons of it, tens of millions of dollars every day. But they are in they're coming off a growth period. American Airlines, however, is less financially stable than the others. It has had, I'm not going to say it being naysayer, but everyone agrees that they have not been as well managed as the others. So they're particularly eager to hasten the retirement of some of their older employees who are already headed that way. And they're going to have to downsize a bit. They're going to have to make some tough decisions, American in particular.
The Association of Professional Flight Attendants reported that just under 8,000 of its members signed up for either voluntary leave or early retirement. And that's out of that 25,300 total. About 7,200 flight attendants signed up for either 3, 6, or 12-month leaves, and about 760 will take early retirement. And both of those, the leave and the retirement, would start in May.
Yeah, they're not going to need as many pilots because there's some analysts have been talking about how airlines might not have a growth year until 2022 or 2023. Because even as the public health risk recedes, people will be reluctant to get on planes and there will be fewer flights. There will be less demand, which means you need fewer pilots. So pilots and flight attendants are, they're going to downsize because they can't pay them as much and they won't need them as much.
And there's another link on this page for the Dallas News, which talks about pilots being tested positive for coronavirus. And they mentioned that 41 American airline pilots so far have tested positive, as have 33 pilots at Southwest. And that was as of 4 days ago. That'll be almost a week by the time people hear this. So, yeah, a lot of people are unfortunately getting sick at the same time as well.
Yeah, I don't think any profession or group of people is immune to being touched by this virus, unfortunately. Sort of the key underlying question that nobody can answer is what the long-term impact of this is on, just to say commercial aviation, for example. 6 months ago, we were talking about the pilot shortage and how this was probably the best time ever for someone to start to embark upon that type of career. And now we have this virus that we see. And is there a temporary, maybe it lasts a couple of years, maybe not, but a temporary blip, I hate to call this a blip, downturn in the needs, or does it change the trajectory of the curve going out 20 years?
It's still a good career to pursue because the military needs pilots too. So it's still skilled labor. I would not discourage anyone from doing it. They're just, maybe you get a job at a regional carrier. One of the trends I'm looking at is whether or not the SkyWests or the Mesa Airlines or the Air Wisconsins get more or less. This really depends on the scope clause negotiations with unions, is because they could just delegate some of the flying to the regional carriers who fly on the behalf of the majors. Or maybe it'll go the other way. Maybe they'll scoop up the pilots from the carriers and they'll hire them at the majors. But either way, hiring someone fresh from the academy might not be as appealing as someone who's already had a few years of flying under their belt.
Mm-hmm. And the first piece pulled to get hired back are going to be those on furlough. So it's going to probably take a year or more to chew through all those people, get them called back. So I think the new hires are going to be waiting at least a year before they get called. And I'm guessing probably closer to two.
I guess the advice for commercial pilots that you hear often is make sure you have a plan B, another source of income.
Yep. My wife's cousin is also a real estate agent, and he does that on the side.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it helps to have another source of income.
Yeah.
Maybe stay with the military a couple more years. That's where most of the commercial pilots come from, is their former military.
Mm. Well, of course, another group affected by all of this at the airport is the TSA screeners. Tom, the statistic, the numbers of individuals, travelers being screened has just absolutely plummeted.
Yeah, it's gone back to 1950s levels. I saw one estimate that it was 1954, was before the dawn of the jet age, was the last time we had this level, this low a level of people being screened at airports. This is back in the day when there was still tons of turbulence, when you couldn't get on a jet, and flying got so much easier in the 1960s. So we're back at 50s level flying.
The one thing that we're not back to from the 50s is people aren't dressed up in suits and hats and ties when they go on their airline trip. I remember my first airline trip, which was in the around 67, I would guess. And yeah, everybody was dressed up in their Sunday best. So that's not going to come back, I don't think. But yeah, this story here tells us that we are down 96% for the same time last year. So TSA is now screening fewer than 100,000 people a day, which is stunning.
Yeah, and that last year they were screening more than 2 million passengers a day. So that's down, but cargo is up. And Cargofax reports that FedEx puts parked jets back in service to meet Asia cargo surge. FedEx plans to add 150 flights over the next month. What's the cargo that has become so critical? Well, it's masks, protective suits, other healthcare supplies coming to the U.S. from Asia.
The cargo carriers thought there was going to be this big snapback whenever the factories reopened in China. And it was just kind of weird to see all these cargo companies. They had an almost kind of Pollyanna optimism prior to March, where they thought, oh, once this all blows over, there'll be a boom in cargo and, you know, we'll get all the business we want. Part of that came true. You know, everyone is flying cargo now. I mean, all the passenger carriers are flying more cargo than they've flown in years.
Yes. And we see from simpleflying.com that Air Canada is taking the seats out of three of their 777-300ERs so they can use them for cargo. And I tell you, when you look at a photograph of a 777-300 with no seats in it, there's a lot of space inside those things. They're large.
I had exactly the same reaction. That was the comment I was going to make. Just looking at this thing, I don't even know what the analogy is, but it's, oh my gosh, it is a huge amount of space. I mean, it looks to me like you could put a couple lanes of a bowling alley.
That's what I thought too. It looks like a bowling alley kind of, especially with the the seat tracks that are still there.
Yeah. I mean, almost
a movie theater. These giant airliners that you fly across oceans in, you know, they're made to fly across oceans. So they literally have movie screens for passengers.
Yes, they're large. So Air Canada is taking the 422 seats out of these aircraft. They say that it will let them carry twice the cargo. They're creating loading zones and installing netting. So I take this to mean that it's not a full freighter conversion, because I think when you do that with a passenger aircraft like this, you strengthen the floor and there's a lot of modifications that are made. So they say they can carry twice the cargo. They probably have a lot more than twice the space, but I would imagine the load restrictions of the airframe are dictating how much weight you can put up there where the people would have been otherwise.
And I think that's spot on. I think the trade-off is if they were trying to go through the normal freighter conversion, it would take months. Instead, they're able to do this in 6 days. Plus, it'll be very easy for them to put the seats back in and restore these to passenger service. So, yes, I think that's why they're not doing the full freighter conversion, even though they won't be able to carry as much weight as they would. But if you think about it, a lot of the medical supplies that they're carrying are pretty lightweight. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like you're bringing huge amounts of iron. You're bringing masks and protective equipment that's made out of plastic. I mean, I would imagine that even if it were a full-size cargo jet, that you would really cube out before you max out. That is, you would fill out you know, the space before you ever reach the weight limit.
All right. 1 mile at a time has an article, Alaska Airlines creative new tag flights. So this is interesting. We touched on this kind of before. The government aid under the CARES Act requires U.S. airlines to avoid involuntary furloughs or employee layoffs, and they also have to continue service to all existing markets. But Max T, the airlines are kind of, I don't know if this is looking at it creatively or if this was kind of intended.
Makes total sense to me. If you have to serve all the markets that you previously served, the question becomes, how do you do that without going broke? And I think this is really clever response that I wouldn't have thought of. And I've never heard the expression tag flights before. Maybe that's not a standard expression in the industry, but it's kind of like, tagging, a base when you're playing baseball or something like, you got to make some presence known there. So instead of, they give many, many examples here, but one example they give is instead of having a flight from Seattle to Dallas and a flight from Seattle to Houston, Alaska will instead fly from Seattle to Dallas to Houston. So that means far fewer direct flights than you used to have. On the other hand, the load factors are so low, if you've only got 5% of the airplane full, well, gosh, now you've got 10% of the airplane full. So this is at least some improvement, and it's not that much inconvenience for passengers.
So if you're a large airline, the way that this requirement is being interpreted, I guess, is that, again, if you're large, you might have a number of flights daily to a specific destination. And if you interpret the requirement as not you have to maintain the same number of flights to that destination, you just have to continue to serve that destination, then a large airline could fly just one flight to that destination and still presumably meet the requirement here. But if you're small, like Alaska Airlines, relatively, and let's say only fly to each destination or many destinations once each day, then you don't have the benefit of being able to cut back on the number of flights because, you've got to serve that destination. So that's where Alaska Airlines got creative, as they say here, and created this tag flight strategy.
Yeah, the DOT set, because the minimum service requirements are part of the requirement for aid, which basically everyone is applying for, so they're all going to have to do this. Alaska's one of the larger ones, but it says a carrier that provides more than 10% of the total U.S. domestic capacity will have to keep servicing the most flights. Like they would need to keep doing the most weekly flights. Alaska's probably under 10%. I think only the majors, some of the biggest ones, fly more than 10% of all capacity in the United States. Alaska's big, but it's not that big. So I think they get some of the breaks that the smaller ones are going to get. They don't have to fly as many weekly flights. They don't need to, so they're going to get some of those breaks.
Yeah, but they're more than 10% of Alaska.
Yes, Alaska is the biggest state by landmass, and it is also the closest to the Arctic. Raven Air is low. We're going to discuss Raven Air in a few minutes, I think. But they are part of the Essential Air Service because that specifically mentions Alaska and Hawaii in the Essential Air Service.
Well, Micah sent in an item of interest concerning impact on airports, on airport planning and design specifically. And this comes from a company called HOK, and they're a global design, architecture, engineering, and planning firm. And they have some comments on areas where they see there may or may not need to be physical changes to terminals, for example, in response to COVID-19 and such things. And they don't foresee the need to make significant changes to the terminals themselves because they say passenger terminals have been designed to be open and flexible. So there's really nothing they need to change. They can accommodate what they might need to accommodate without that. But they do note that things like thermal scanners and handheld thermometers so that travelers could be screened is something else that could be easily accommodated by airports. but they suggest that airports might look at more comprehensive passenger wellness screening solutions. And they say that we may also see, quote, additional medical clinics within airports for use by passengers as well as airport and airline employees. They also talk about things like the need possibly for quarantine areas for people displaying symptoms. So, when air traffic resumes at a healthy rate and, wide body comes in from overseas and disgorges hundreds of passengers, if they need to be screened, temperature taken, that sort of thing, what are you going to do with the travelers that don't pass the test?
And here's something I had never really thought about. Think of how many things you end up touching when you go through an airport. Probably the thing that never occurred to me is you go up to a self-service kiosk, for example, to check your bag or to get a boarding pass. It's like, how many hundreds of people have touched that darn screen, before you arrived? Never thought about that before. And so they've also talked about it. Are there other kinds of things we can do? Could we have automated doors to, open in the restroom or to, open the front doors or things like that, going into a lounge, for example. And are there other ways to clean and disinfect? I keep wondering, instead of those thermometers that they would point at your forehead, could we do it at a distance, and aim it at the front door? Yeah. The moment someone with a fever walks in, alarms go off.
Yeah. Door stops revolving.
Exactly. We're no longer worried about people bringing, terrible destructive things into the airport. We're worried about the viruses they're bringing into the airport. It's the next level of detection that's required.
I went on a flight in March and I didn't have to take my shoes off. They said it's a special occasion.
Well, the other thing I was just thinking about with all of, we've worked so hard to have self-service kiosks, self-service bagging, self-service this, self-service that. Maybe we go back to old school, going up to a counter and speaking to a person who's got gloves on and handling stuff instead of all of this automated. Maybe we take a step back, all of this stuff that we have to touch, it might be easier just to start, you want to bring back the economy, hire more people to pack bags and take tickets and stuff like that. We've got things so automated now that, maybe we need to rethink things.
Well, people always talk about, cash is dirty. I was just thinking, you go up to the Starbucks at the airport, there's a line of 20 people, you pull out your credit card and a lot of people have been messing with that credit card, reader. Maybe this will accelerate the use of, cardless payment systems, Apple Pay and some of these other things where you, show a screen and you don't have to actually, put your fingers on that filthy, disgusting credit card reader.
Yeah, I'm thinking that the degree to which this changes everything going forward depends on a couple of things. One is how long does this last? Obviously, I think, and this is kind of obvious, I guess, that the longer it goes on, the more likely it is to create long-term changes. But another factor is cost. So if it tends to motivate long-term changes, that's the way we do things. How much do those different options cost? And if they cost a lot, then I'm not sure that industry will have an appetite for spending the money. If it doesn't cost much to make a change, then it's different.
And one of the immediate changes has just been the closure of some terminals. You look at the international terminal at SFO, that was a $1 billion addition, and they've shut down most of that terminal at this point. I know there are other terminals that are, being closed off because they're not needing the space. Now, I keep wondering, this is not directly aviation related, with all the local companies that have had people working at home now, some of them started long before the mandatory closures. So you look at Google, Facebook, Salesforce, and Apple, they started sending people home almost 6 weeks ago. And you look at the phenomenal amount of money they spend on commercial real estate. I wonder if at some point they're going to go, you know, we can save a whole lot of money on these expensive buildings if we just leave, you know, people at home. And if that were to happen, that would definitely throw the commercial real estate market into upheaval.
Hmm. All right. Well, we have an item from The Drive on a completely different subject, completely different topic. And this is, this man owns the world's most advanced private air force after buying 46 FA-18 Hornets. David, this how does one buy 46 Hornets?
Well, you need to find 46 Hornets, and evidently Australia was perfectly willing to get rid of them. They actually moved one of their squadrons of legacy Hornets. Yes, Grant, I said that, and to all my Australian listeners, the proper way. They're legacy Hornets, not classics. And they sent them to Canada to supplement the Canadian Air Force. The rest of them, they've sold privately to come here to the United States to become bad guys, which is really kind of amazing. But Don Curlin was an airline pilot, then real estate, and purchased his first L-39 and then built his way up and now owns 46 F-18 Hornets. What's interesting about these Hornets is they're not demilitarized. They are going to be combat-ready Hornets, and it's not often. And Launchpad didn't have this happen, but he didn't have to go to the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms to get a license to operate his aircraft, whereas this gentleman actually had to. So what are they going to be? Well, they're going to be aggressors or adversaries. You know, we've talked about that a lot, that, you know, the aggressor squadrons and the Navy adversary squadrons, the military is farming out. So now we're going to have F-22s up against F-18s and F-18s up against F-18s. So currently in the United States now, we have F-1s, Mirages. We've got, we'll soon have F-18s. We've got F-16s in private hands. We've got various third world country aircraft up to state-of-the-art F-18s. It's going to be interesting to see how this goes on for training, you know. And one of the things the article says was what the plans are is it's not 46 aircraft, which is, you know, usually you think maybe 24 aircraft with 16 spares. They want all 46 aircraft to be operational. They are getting all the spare parts and such. So it's going to be interesting to have a Air Force. There's a lot of countries that have less jet fighters than this gentleman owns privately.
So what happens is then for these training exercises, David, is that the military hires him as a contractor to provide these aircraft? Is that the way that it works? And who pilots the aircraft?
There's 46 aircraft that are going to need pilots. Now, a lot of these contract organizations like ATAC and other ones use former military pilots. Way back in the day, you heard me talk about Dale Snodgrass, who was an F-14 pilot, and Jive. They fly adversaries. So you get highly skilled military pilots who retire from the military and still want to get their jet fixed. So they act as offensive instructors, you know. And so Red Flag has been using A4s, and soon we'll be using these Mirage F1s from Spain. And so they're all sort of acting as the bad guys, which is really kind of cool. Now, the Navy has been flying F-18s as bad guys for a long time. So, but they still fly older F-5s as well as, you know, the Air Force flying F-16s, all of which are small squadrons. But now you've got multiple squadrons, and you don't have to be confined. You can deploy them to a reserve base, and they could intergauge with, so you're up training, you know, and this is a big deal, you know. And things like Red Flag will even have more up training. So, but it's a lot of airplanes. It's a lot of military hardware. And, you know, 46 aircraft, that's half of a carrier battle group for an air wing. I mean, you can start talking about things like that. So, you know, most squadrons have 12 aircraft. You know, what I did see a lot of controversy when I posted this to Twitter was the Australians are a little concerned that they're not even going to get to keep any for their museums. I have a feeling that they'll be able to get one or two of them for their museums, but it's going to be an interesting prospect.
All right, let's move on to a few positive airline stories. Mr. Trescott, are you the new positive airline story champion of this little show?
Absolutely.
What do we have here?
Well, I think I'd have to go back to the Wayback Machine and see what we talked about last week. But I think we talked about United Airlines flying medical volunteers into New York City for free. Anyway, they're doing it on the West Coast as well. They have partnered with the governor here in California to provide free round-trip flights for volunteers who are medical people flying to California to help fight the front lines of the COVID-19 crisis. And I also heard separately that they are working on hotel rooms for these people as well.
Wow.
And of course, I think they got deep discounts on those rooms because occupancy, we haven't talked about the lodging industry, but I'm guessing they're just about as have the same kind of poor occupancy as the airlines do. So this is great. I will say that it does appear that in the last couple of days that we look like we're pretty much at a peak here in California. If you look at the new cases, it doesn't seem like the new cases per day is growing. It's still pretty steady. So at least things aren't getting worse. So that's good. Mm. Sounds like we may have at least reached a steady state here. And then what we're looking for is for the downturn where we start getting fewer new cases per day.
And then Alaska Airlines has stepped up, I guess, to try and compensate for Ravenair. Tom mentioned Ravenair, the small, they're a regional airline. They serve small Alaskan communities primarily. And I guess they've ceased operations, but Alaska Airlines is stepping in.
Yeah, this is I was encouraged by this because it's one of those stories where you really, like I mentioned, that Alaska and Hawaii are specifically mentioned in the essential air service. They're these areas that need air travel because they're so remote, and you know, Hawaii is an island and Alaska is freaking huge. So I was kind of disturbed when I found out that Raven Air Group was, first they suspended operations, and then just 2-3 days later they said they were going bankrupt. For temporarily, you know, it's a different kind of, they're seeking bankruptcy protection so that they can stay in business and they can enter some kind of debt. And they hope that they'll be able to start up again. It doesn't, you know, we'll see how that goes. But so they're not completely done. But it really shocked people because I talked to the post office and they, this happened on a Thursday, and the post office was left scrambling to find contractors to deliver people their mail. Hundreds of towns were going to be without mail delivery, and they managed to do it, but it shows you that real people, you know, lots of people would have been isolated from the cargo and mail deliveries that they needed that Raven Air was providing. And you know, Raven Air Group owns three small airlines. They have some propeller aircraft and like de Havillands and such. But it's necessary in Alaska because it's the largest state by air mass and by land mass. So Alaska Airlines is stepping in, and they, because they're the biggest carrier in Alaska, and they're hosting a job fair for Raven employees. They have a hiring freeze at Alaska Airlines, but the same day that Raven Air said they were seeking bankruptcy protection, a press release came out from Alaska Airlines said, we're working with the governor, we're working with the fishing industries, where, you know, everyone who needs this air travel, they said, we'll step in, we'll help you out. They offered to help the Raven employees find work. It's, you know, part of it is filling the void, you know, because they're big and they can kind of absorb the market a little bit, but it's also genuinely helping people who really need this service.
Yeah, very good. And for folks who aren't familiar with Raven Air, it's R-A-V-N.
Yeah.
Yeah, Raven.
I wasn't familiar with it until they had problems a few months back. Somebody hacked their they had really old airplanes. They had these de Havillands, and that was the first I heard of them. You know, it's a small regional air group in Alaska that you probably never heard of.
Yeah, they were new to me. And then American Airlines has been raising some money, haven't they?
This is a great story. American Airlines raised more than $1 million in the first 24 hours of this campaign to help fund the American Red Cross. Now, I can see on the Red Cross website that American has long been a corporate partner and sponsor, but it looks like during the current pandemic that they have stepped up the campaign as well. And American is doing something rather interesting as well to help spur donations. And for anybody who is looking for mileage cheaply on American, you may want to do this. They're offering 10 miles to anybody who donates for every dollar that they donate through the end of April. Now, the minimum donation has to be $25, but they'll give you 10 miles for every dollar that you donate to the Red Cross. I went out and looked just to see what is the value of American Airlines miles. And this best estimate is 3.5 cents. So you multiply that by 10, that says you're getting back about 35 cents of value for every dollar that you donate. So it looks like it's a good deal all the way around for everybody involved.
Very good. All right. Well, Tom, have you observed anything else, associated with the condition we find ourselves in with the industry? I guess you have also looked at a few impacts on, I don't know, aerospace or the space segment.
Yeah, you have to think about how IATA says that there are 25 million jobs worldwide at risk during this downturn, you know, at airlines and related to airlines, because you have to remember that there's the aircraft manufacturers, there's the contractors that work for those aircraft manufacturers, there are the companies that airlines outsource to, there's an entire ecosystem of companies that are reliant on the success of the airline industry. So that's the big picture of the trouble that we're in. And like you said, Airbus is cutting production. People are finally canceling their 737 MAX orders. I mean, they were patients that they knew the 737 MAX was going to go back into service eventually. But now that they're cash strapped, they're, you know, some people are changing their minds after all these months of waiting. So there's a lot of, there's going to be, like I said, there might not be a growth year for airlines until 2022 or 2023. And we're in a bear market. You know, that means with all of these aircraft with lower demand, that means lower need for aircraft. And you have to remember that when there is a glut on the market like this, when everyone is parking their aircraft and everyone is trying to leverage their aircraft to get some kind of financing, you know, because even after they get the money from the government, airlines want to get more capital. JetBlue and Delta Airlines have said they both want to get more capital. And that usually their assets are airplanes. Everyone is going to try to sell their airplanes, and that means that they are going to become less valuable. So that's one thing you have to keep in mind, is that it's an asset that is going to become much less valuable. I don't know how there are people who analyze the values of aircraft, and you could take a closer look at that with them. But it's definitely going to be, you know, the price of an aircraft is not going to be as much as it was a year ago. And some of the problems with that are how do all these workers keep their jobs? You know, the funding will go through the end of September. September 30th is where the payroll grants protection ends. Maybe Congress will pass some other legislation, because people have said that pool of $25 billion for passenger air carriers won't be enough. We'll see what happens as this drags on.
Yeah, and at that date, of course, the election in the United States will be on everyone's mind, and that will, I would guess, probably heavily influence what Congress does, you know, around that time.
I'm not sure if that would be a benefit or a hazard for them. You know, maybe do you want Pete to give people money, or will they criticize you for giving people money? It's interesting how that dynamic, because a year ago, people would have said, like, universal basic income is now being considered by the government, by the same people who would have said, no, that would be terrible, it would destroy our republic. And now they're considering doing it.
Sure. It's always terrible if it's for somebody else, but hey, if it's for me, that's not socialism. Yeah. send me my check. I'm curious, Tom, you were talking about perhaps the ability to borrow against the assets, and it seems like airlines often don't own their airplanes. Many of them are leased. Any idea what the split is for a typical airline, how many of them are leased versus how many are owned?
I think here's one other factor. I mentioned that American Airlines, like all the major airlines are doing okay. They're coming off a growth period, but American Airlines has not been financially managed as well. But Southwest Airlines may be the best managed. So Southwest owns all its airplanes, and a lot of the majors also own all their airplanes. It's when you get to the smaller carriers, like the regional carriers, that they don't own all their airplanes. Most of them are private, so we don't know how many of the ones, like I think Mesa Airlines and SkyWest Airlines are the only two publicly traded regional carriers in the United States. So we don't know all the details of what's leased, what's borrowed, what is, you know, owned outright. So that's when it gets difficult. That's why the regional airlines were saying, hey, we're in a special financial situation because we don't all own our aircraft. We're not all publicly traded. It could be harder for us to get debt. So but the value of aircraft is unquestionably going to go down because nobody's going to be able to fly them and everybody's going to want to sell them. Hmm. I don't know how much it's going to go. I don't want to be a naysayer, but it's going to be less than it was a year ago for the next couple of years.
Well, you know, we've been saying for quite a while that these are not dull times for aviation. We've been saying that for years for different reasons in the past. But, you know, now we've got an unpleasant reason, but nonetheless a reason to say the same thing now. In a completely different vein, just before we started recording, I saw that, and this is a completely different topic, but the FAA has issued an NPRM concerning supersonic aircraft noise. You may recall that Congress, and I don't remember the exact words, but Congress directed the FAA to be supportive, or again, I'm not sure what the words are, of supersonic flight, to encourage it. So I haven't seen the NPRM. I haven't had a chance to do that, but I'm really interested to see what that says. I don't know if the current condition and the economic fallout might impact the ability of those companies who are trying to develop supersonic transports, if they're going to be affected by this or not.
Yeah, it's interesting. The NPRM relates to takeoff and landing noise. So that's just the start, because takeoff and landing, that's the FAA regulates the noise of aircraft, and supersonic aircraft would have different kinds of engines. Like that, you can't just put like the demonstrator that NASA's flying, that they're going to fly. They haven't flown it yet. It has, I think, an FA-17. It's a Hornet engine. It's a FA-16, I think, and so it's a jet engine. It's not a commercial engine. So it's a fighter engine, because they don't have a specific engine built for these yet. That's what these companies are going to build. So new engines means new rules. So that's the start. But the real challenge will come in when the NASA does its demonstrator flights, because it's got this new design to mitigate the noise of a sonic boom. This is the actual name they've come up with, into a sonic thump.
Right.
They won't make a sonic boom into a sonic thump. This is the actual name. Because that noise carries for like 50 miles, a 50-mile circular radius. So anybody in the area would hear it. So the United States has a Mach 1 speed limit. Doesn't matter, you know, and it doesn't matter how low it, you know. So that regulation will have to change. And NASA is going to, I don't know how the virus is going to affect these flights that they have planned, but they built these planes. They want to fly them over communities and get some data back about how loud it is. And after they have the data, then all the people will get together and they'll come up with some more regulations. And eventually they will come up with rules that these companies will follow to be able to fly over land. But the takeoff and landing rule that is, you know, being put in place would give some of the carriers the chance to, you know, if they bought the planes, the chance to fly over the oceans, like the Concorde did. The Concorde flew, obviously, from New York to London. And the, like, boom supersonic is optimistic that that would be enough for the near future. And some business, you know, startups that are making business jets, like Aireon, they want to fly over the ocean for, you know, whoever wants to fly internationally super quick, like twice the time. Because when you're over the ocean, obviously there's no rules about, there's no speed limit. Nobody owns the ocean. But the real money for the carriers, because the United States is the biggest market for commercial air travel in the world. So that's the big prize. So that's the real, like, I don't know how soon we're going to get to that with all this virus mess. But once NASA does its flights, then the real regulation will begin for noise of supersonic flight. And I remember I was at the Chamber of Commerce meeting at the start of March, and people kind of knew that it was going to get bad. There was hand sanitizer at every table, and they were encouraging people to be safe. But they still didn't really realize just how bad this, you know, how bad the shutdown was going to get. And when there was a panel discussion about supersonic commercial flight, it was not well received. People thought it was kind of tone deaf. People thought, are you kidding? Airlines are going to be struggling to survive. This is not the right time to talk about this. So startups are in trouble. Like space startup OneWeb had to file for bankruptcy. They'd already started launching satellites for a broadband satellite program they have going. And I haven't heard anything about Ariane Supersonic or Boom Supersonic. But I mentioned earlier, if you're getting your money from the government, then that's a stable source of revenue. The airlines are going to get some subsidies from the government to help them stay afloat. They can borrow against their planes. But if you're building a new emerging class of aircraft and you're relying on rounds of funding as a startup, then that's unstable. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't want to be a naysayer, but it is much less stable than even the airline's position.
It does make you wonder if this might accelerate some of the bankruptcies that we've kind of been expecting with the 100-plus companies that are developing vertical takeoff and landing aircraft.
I don't know if it would accelerate the I like those. I mean, I think that it's someone's going to get that right. But yeah, some of those are going to stop financing because they'll need to, you know, they're relying on rounds of funding.
All right. Well, Tom, we want to thank you for all your insights, and it's great to have you back, and we look forward to maybe having you back in the future if you like.
I'd love that.
Great. What's up with the geeks? Max West, how about you?
Well, as I said, day 36 of the hostage crisis, but it continues to evolve a little bit. I've had a couple big writing projects on the back burner, and I'm happy to say that one of them is starting to look like I might eventually get to the end of it. So that's kind of fun to think about. And though I have to tell you, I've almost been reluctant to finish. It's like, hey, you know, I just keep polishing this thing. It's like, no, you got to let the baby get born at some point. You can't just keep working on it forever. But teaching on Zoom has increased a little bit. I had two clients with Zoom sessions today where we're giving ground instruction for various ratings that they are working on. Let me think. One is working on their private and one is working on their instrument. We can't really fly, so we're still knocking off some of the things we would have to do anyway. And today we celebrated with our first at-home pizza delivery. So that was kind of fun to get that set up. So, and actually, I have some blood pressure medication that I take on a regular basis. And for the first time, that's going to be delivered as well too. So it's kind of nice not to have to run outside to do some of these things that we've been used to doing in the past.
Very good. All right, David, anything new with you or same old, hold up at home?
Hold up at home. Went out, what, 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Had an interesting scientific experiment or a sociology experiment. The week before, I went to the store and nobody was wearing masks. And then last week, it looks like, well, in our state here in Pennsylvania, we were told that if you go out to public places, you must wear a mask. It was kind of funny. The first week without the mask, people were sort of not looking at you like, if I don't acknowledge they exist, I won't catch the virus. and yet, once everybody started wearing masks, it was kind of nice. You could see them sort of smile under their with their eyes and say hello and stuff. Like, so it's an interesting social experiment there about, you know,
the way the people react differently, you know, when I guess all of us wearing our masks made it feel like we're all in this together. So that was an interesting experiment. And my other goal in life now is to drive Max flight crazy, because I've been baking cookies and cakes and pies quite often. And I just,
and pictures and you make me drool and pine for fresh baked goods.
Well, you know, I keep telling you, it's easily done. It's just you have to do it.
Yeah, but if I do it, I'll eat it, and then I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have to worry about that. You know, I'm still in the I need to gain weight mode.
All right. Well, we've been hearing from some of you about what you guys have been doing at home. We heard from Ed. Ed said, since I can't play tennis or golf with my buddies while I'm locked down, here's what keeps me busy. He says, I spend time with three of my aviation sims, general aviation, combat, and sailplane. He says the GA aircraft encompasses everything from a Boeing 747 and 787 to a Cessna Mustang executive jet and numerous prop planes. Many of these have the Garmin 750 integrated into them, and I'm learning all the bells and whistles. Says my DCS combat sim provides a chance to study the complex weapons systems. And right now I'm working on carrier operations with both the F-14 and F-18. The sim's super carrier launches in the middle of April, so I'm anxiously awaiting its many features, such as an animated deck crew that assists in launch procedures and such. The sim's robust mission builder allows you to create scenarios involving an F-18 attacking adversaries in the Persian Gulf with a Harpoon missile. These things are just so incredible these days. The sailplane sim lets you tow or winch launch selected sailplanes in just about any part of the world, New Zealand and the Great Pyrenees being some of my favorites. I recently started virtual reality with all of these sims, and it's a blast. He says, as if this isn't enough to keep me occupied, my auto racing sims are really cool. I'm able to drive many of my favorite race cars on tracks around the world, from Laguna Seca, perhaps my favorite, having attended races there over the years, to Monaco. When time allows, I need to get the VR going with the auto racing sims. And Ed says he gets his exercise walking around the golf course that he lives on and stops at the greens to do some putting. And then he closes, special thanks to Max T. I use his Garmin manual to help with the GPS in the Cessna Mustang. I happened to have retired from the firm he worked for, HP. And that's from Ed, who's also in California.
Down in Southern California, Escondido. So, Ed, thanks so much for buying a copy of my Max Truscott G1000 Glass Cockpit Handbook. And, yeah, I bet you're having a good time in the Mustang. That's a fun little jet.
All right. Earlier this year, Airplane Geeks reporter-at-large Launchpad Marzari tagged along with our Rob Mark, Flying Magazine's senior editor, as he was writing an article for the magazine. This is a really, really interesting kind of peek behind the curtain at what it takes to put together an article for, you know, a significant aviation magazine. So Launchpad and Rob had a really good conversation, and we'll play that right now.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. It's your reporter-at-large, Launchpad Marzari. Hey, I started to do an aircraft review and realized it would just be another aircraft review. Instead, I wanted to take the listeners behind the scenes, someplace we haven't been, what's involved to write an aircraft review in an aviation story. So to do this, I blackmailed senior editor at Flying Magazine, Rob Mark, to let me tag along with him while he was starting to write a story. And I have him here on microphone right now. Good morning, Rob.
Hey, hi, how are you? Thank you for inviting me. And thank you for that nice ride in that fancy Uber when we met in San Antonio.
It was all part of the package.
I've never ridden in an Uber quite like that, but again, thank you for that.
You're more than welcome. And let's start with the germs of the story. Let me preface the question. Who decides what the story is? Do you go to the editor and say, "Oh, please, sir, may I write 250 words about the Boeing 737 MAX? I think it might be a big story." Or does the assignment come down from on high where they point their finger at you and say, "You, write 2,000 words on the social impact of podcasting and its positive impact on the aviation business economy"? You know?
Well, that's an interesting question you asked, that secondary one, but we'll save that for another time. Actually, it's some of both. Because so many of us that are staff started out as freelancers, we're kind of used to, at least I am, I'm used to pitching ideas. I see a story and I go, "Ooh, I know who would like that." And then I would try to pitch it to the editor. So even though I'm full-time employed with flying, I still do that. And, you know, sometimes they go, "Yeah, maybe we could do that." Or, "We'll think about that." But then again, there are times that the stories come to us. And when it comes to pilot reports, it's usually the manufacturer that says, "Hey, we have this nifty, cool, new, you know, Shazam airplane.
Widget.
Widget. Yeah. And we'd really love one of your folks to come take a look at it and see what they think of it. We'll let them fly it if they want." And so we usually try to take on those assignments. And then it's sometimes the editor's job to decide who is going to get that particular one, you know, for, you know, that particular model or whatever. Sometimes it's geographics that put the writer closer to the story than somebody else. But sometimes it's the complexity of the airplane, you know, so it's a bunch of variables.
Now let's talk about word count. And when you first get the assignment, are you whether you're assigned it or whether you're pitching it, are you negotiating with them, "Look, I think there's, you know," and I don't know word counts. So, you know, "Hey, this is like a 2-page story," and I don't know what that would be, as opposed to, "Hey, this is 8 pages and worthy of the cover." Is that kind of determined before you go out and look at it? Or do you have a ballpark idea of this is going to be a 1-page story or a paragraph among the what's new and cool? Or?
Yeah, I think we often do. A 1-pager for us is probably 300 words, maybe 350. So, you know, a good pilot report is going to be probably somewhere around 2,000, because you need time to kind of explain the airplane. If it's a new airplane, like when you and I saw that Colt, I need to go into how the company came along, how it evolved from, you know, the builder and evolved into a certified airplane and you know, maybe some of the production process and all that. And then there's the, here's how it came out when we actually got in the airplane and flew it. And certainly some things will jump out at you. Like I think we saw when we got there, that door that opens wide, that's easy for almost anybody to get into. That's a big deal in a small airplane.
Yeah, including large, overweight reporters at large.
And the fact that they were smart enough to move the wing strut behind the door as opposed to in front of it, as Cessna did, that's pretty practical. I mean, from the pilot's stand. So those kinds of things go into it. And then, you know, what's the startup like? Or what was the walk around like? And then, you know, getting into it, how did it feel when you reach for things? Did it feel like everything was in sight? And so you're thinking of all these things. I can tell that story in 2,000 words, I think. I'll tell the editor. But there have been stories that I've written for other publications when I was a freelancer that they'd say, "No, we want 4,000 words. "Okay. You'll have 4,000 words. And then I have more latitude to kind of fill in the blanks about the product and the derivation of it and what makes it special and some of the characteristics. But these days, usually the stories are smaller, or I should say shorter.
When you're running down a story, how hard is it to contact the representative or the subject of the story? Now, I realize let's use Texas Aircraft, because when you and I went there, that was the third attempt at the story.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, in our particular case, it was not the aircraft manufacturer's problem. It was just simply a manpower issue, because at the time there was really only two of us full-timers able to go. You know, we got close to the first date and then something got in the way. And then the second date, the same thing. The editor called and said, look, you got to be here, not there. And you just have to call him and say, I'm sorry, but we'll have to postpone it. And so I really worked hard this time to make sure that this was not going to go sideways, because, you know, for one thing, you know, they're doing us a favor letting us fly their airplane, but you also don't want any publication to get a reputation as people that can't keep to a schedule or something like that. So it's really important to get the story done. And so I said, I am going down there. If it kills me, I'm getting there.
Right. Because you tried to link up with them when they were demonstrating away from the factory somewhere in the Midwest, in Indiana or something.
That's right. And in Illinois, and they were at the Midwest LSA show down in Southern Illinois. And I said, oh, that'd be great. They don't have to do all that. Well, and then the airplane I used from our flying club went into maintenance, and I didn't have it available, so I had no way to get down there, because it's kind of a in the middle of nowhere kind of airport. So that idea went down. I think another time I tried to get to San Antonio by connecting on Southwest through Houston or something, and they canceled the flight over to San Antonio till the next day, but that was going to kind of wipe out the stuff happens.
All right. Now, when you're going to do this, do you have a theme or a conjecture or a hypotenuse that you're trying to prove, you know, or do you just go in cold? Because like in this one, we seem to be hitting up the theme that the Texas aircraft cult seems to be the inheritor of the one Cessna 150.
I think that lineage back to the 150 was simply my idea, because I have spent so much time, as an instructor in a 150. And I remember even when I was young and I was flexible, you know, you'd get out of that airplane after three or four students in a day. And, oh, my God, you know, your back ached and your legs were stiff. And because it's a tight fit. And so when I saw that and I saw the capabilities of it, I said, wow, it sounds like a 150 replacement or some just off the top of my head. And the marketing guy that we talked to had said on the phone, well, you know, actually that's kind of the market we're aiming at. And I said, okay. So
you didn't go down there with a hypotenuse to prove disprove.
No,
it was just kind of like, okay, let's see what the story brings us.
Absolutely. I mean, and because you never know what you're going to experience. And it's the same way on big airplanes. When I go to Gulfstream, I was at Gulfstream last year to fly one of their new airplanes, and it was the Gulfstream 500 that had a new active side stick and you know, no more control wheel in the cockpit, and I went, oh wow, that's pretty cool. That's the first Gulfstream that's had that, and I thought, well, let's see how they brought it to market. Let's see what it looks like, what it feels like. So you have to kind of go in there going, oh, wow, that's pretty neat. And how does this work? And where did this go? And how did you, and, you know, I'm either writing all this, I'm trying to record more of it these days with a digital recorder, because there's,
we're going to get into that for a second.
Oh, okay.
I want to come back to the fact that when you're doing this as normal, Flying Magazine isn't paying for the hours in the aircraft. Normally, the vendor lets us go fly it for a reasonable amount of time on their nickel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even when it's a jet, because to them, you know, we're paying the expenses to get down there and back. I mean, the magazine pays for that. But the manufacturer usually says, we care enough about the readership of the magazine to say, this is worth us, you know, covering the cost. I mean, and you know, right. let's say it is Colt. I mean, and Colt had us down there. They had AOPA pilot down there. They had plane and pilot down there. They had AvWeb at one point. So, you know, they kind of tried.
We all weren't there at the same time. Let's make sure our listeners understand that.
That's a good point. No, you're right. We're not all there at the same time because that absolutely would not work. I tried that once years ago when I went to a British Aerospace rollout of a turboprop, and they had five editors there all at the same time, and they had slots for us. Rob, you're flying 10 to 12, and Nigel, you're flying noon to 2, and David was 2 to 4, and that was it. And you got your story or you didn't get it. And that's kind of tough because you saw we had time to sit and schmooze with these people and they showed us around. And that's kind of the way I would rather do it.
Right. And during the flying, for our listeners, what happened was we did a walk around, and the walk around took longer than normal because we would stop and ask about special features or why did you do this or why is this here? Oh, that's a neat idea. Look, they moved this thing over here. Asking questions that weren't relevant, like, look, are there hard points for drop tanks? No, we didn't do that. Oh, okay. Sure.
And I think that, you know, it's important that listeners know that the reason we're asking those questions is that a lot of times it's very basic information, but, you know, the manufacturer says, oh, you know, that's a good point. Yeah, please point that out to the readers who are potential buyers of the airplane. Because someone else might hear, you know, read the story going, oh, wow, you know, I've gotten a little larger over the years. And wow, a door that really opens up, for instance, that's a big deal. You know, right. I think I better take a look at that.
Well, and I also note that unlike what you just described earlier with the, you know, the British thing, is that, for instance, when you guys taxied out to do your demo ride, you spent a great deal of time on the run-up. And I'm sure that you were, you know, getting this explained or that explained because it wasn't under a timetable. And then, in fact, we were able to ask you to modify your takeoff so that we could do some photographs of the aircraft. And I'm sure that's something that they were, you know, they were gracious in letting us do that.
Oh, yeah. And usually the manufacturers are flexible. They don't assign, I think even they realize that it's not worth assigning one of these airplanes to a writer and a demo pilot if they're going to rush them. Because honestly, the last thing you want is for a writer to write a story and say, however, we didn't really have time to evaluate that because we were pressed for time. And, you know, the manufacturer doesn't want that either.
Under the legal perspective of flying, it doesn't matter whether you're flying an LSA or a jet. The way this legally works is that there's a corporate instructor pilot with you, and he's technically the PIC for the aircraft.
Correct. Whether it's a little airplane or a big, you know, in a big airplane, of course, a two-pilot crew, they are still the PIC. But of course, you know, an ATP rated pilot is able to give essentially flight instruction. So that's how they kind of get around that. But again, there's almost always me in the left seat, a demo pilot in the right seat, and they'll often, oops, hang on. Wait, Brett, hang on. I'm sorry, I got to put you on hold for 1 second there.
Stop.
Okay, hang on. I'm sorry, I didn't realize what was going to happen when my cell phone started ringing there.
Now, when you went down to write about the Colt, how do you keep it straight? Because you came straight from riding, or I should say experiencing, the Pilatus PC-12 up in Denver. And you hadn't written that story, and now you're down here riding at the extreme other end of aviation. How do you keep the story straight when you're trying to write them?
It's actually an interesting question. I don't know what other writers do, but when I'm out on an assignment for an airplane, I have a whole little folder that I work with. for, you know, physical on-site stuff. I mean, brochures or whatever the heck it is. But I find that it's easier to just open a folder on my laptop and I'll throw everything in there, transcripts, photos, you know, comments, everything. I mean, you may remember we got a comment from somebody at the factory there as we were leaving, and I basically wrote that down and saved it as a Word file and stuck it in the same folder so that when I'm ready to write the story, I can go back into just that folder and go, okay, I'm on Pilatus now, or ooh, I'm on Colt, and I'm just surrounded by nothing but the data for that. Normally, I wouldn't be doing two airplane reports at the same time. This just kind of happened because of the you know, the way that
scheduling worked out.
Yeah, the way the scheduling worked out. Thank you for that. I always get stuck with those big concepts.
How do you prevent your experiences on the Pilatus from contaminating your experiences on the Colt, or vice versa?
I think that comes from experience. I think that they're very different airplanes, but I mean, I think maybe another way to look at it might be, what if you flew the Pilatus and then I flew the TBM a week later? And, you know, both similar aircraft, that's where it becomes tough. And you just have to kind of bounce back and forth. I always take lots of pictures of the cockpit because I use them for reference when I'm writing the story. And I just go back and look at them, usually on the airplane coming back, and say, okay, oh, I like this. Oh, I remember I didn't like this part of that because it was hard to reach this from there, or oh, this one. Oh, no, I like absolutely the way this was put together. And I'll kind of make notes to myself about it to try to differentiate. Although the goal is not to differentiate necessarily. They might both handle exactly the same in certain situations. And then you just say that, hey, it handled this way. And this next story might read the same in that same area. But usually there are enough differences that you can make it work without getting too confused. But okay, really, that's what we get paid for as well.
Let's talk about timelines. Do you know before the story when it's going to come out? You know, have they sent you there specifically, hey, get this written quickly because it's going to come out here? Because we were down in Texas Aviation in mid-December.
Usually, the magazines always run, you know, behind, which is, I guess I should say, there's a delay in, you know, if a magazine has a June cover date, all those stories, the artwork, everything were probably put together in by mid-April. And that's why magazines are you know, notoriously poor at covering news, because you know, it takes a long time to produce them, because once they're ready, they have to go to the printer. They have to get in the printer's line to be printed, and they have to be assembled, and they have to be mailed, and it takes time. So we have a calendar that says the so-and-so story, the Colt story, for instance. I think for us, it's coming out in the, I think it's the May issue, which means I'll probably have to have the story in by maybe the first week of March of 2020 in order to make my deadline. And then, of course, it gets tossed around the editorial room where other writers read it and make edits to it. And then a copy editor looks at it to make sure I didn't misspell the words or put a comma in the wrong place. And
well, and you know, let me interject something right there. Having just watched another movie about it, does Flying Magazine have an independent fact checker?
No, we do not. We, you know, it, unless something is really glaringly odd about it, you know, they pretty much leave that up to the writers to, you know, make sure they get it straight. In fact, when I was a freelancer, because I started out doing some freelance work for Flying before I was I became their senior editor. We signed a contract that said, hey, by the way, you know that the stuff you're giving us is correct to the best of your knowledge, and that you haven't, you know, made it up as you went along, or, and it was basically a liability form to cover the magazine in case you you didn't do your job or you slipped up. Now, you can make a mistake, and I've certainly had that happen where I'll transpose a number or something, and sometimes that gets past all the editors. And usually what happens is a reader will catch it and say, hey, that doesn't seem to make sense that the Texas Colt had a 145-gallon fuel tank.
And can go Mach 2.
Yeah, yeah.
That it has two Machs.
And we all say that to each other. How did we miss that? But, you know, when you're a writer, you see the same stories again and again. And after a while, whether you want it to or not, your brain gets a little numb, I think.
Well, and to throw a thing out there, famously, what was it, 2 months ago, AOP magazine on their cover was a float plane that was going down to Brazil. And
the one with the cap, gas cap.
Yeah, the fuel cap is off.
Yeah.
Oh, and how many people looked at that and didn't catch it until they actually published it and went, hey, guys, did you skip something on your pre-flight? Look, the gas cap's dangling down.
Oh, and yeah. I thought that was kind of, but that's a perfect example. I think that, again, stuff happens. I mean,
nobody caught it.
No. And it just happens.
Well, speaking of cover stories, as we come to the end of this interview, I want to ask about, we've all seen it where there have been months where AOPA, Flying, EAA Sport Pilot, pick one of the other magazines, and all of you have the same plane on your cover story. Do you consciously kind of secretly go, hey, does anybody know what AOPA is putting on their cover this week so that we don't have the same thing on our cover?
Actually, no, we don't. We don't coordinate with each other. But
I was thinking more like intelligent spies, you know, hey, friend.
Yeah, we don't have spies. We don't check that stuff. So recently I was at Gulfstream when they announced the G700, which is, their newest ultra long range business jet. And so there were editors there, and we all know each other. I mean, Fred George from Aviation Week was there, and a couple of other folks I knew from other publications. And what they did for us is they said, okay, we're going to draw numbers out of a hat. And we drew numbers, and they said, okay, you're going to get, in fact, it was me, you get first pick at which photo your magazine wants to put on the cover. I said, okay, cool. And then, say, Fred chose number two. Well, then Aviation Week got the second choice of photos. So they're all the same airplane, but there's never, they do that so that we don't all have exactly the same photo on the cover at the same time.
Got it. So you've gone down. We've done the actual interview. You've arranged to have an Uber. You take you there. You go to the hotel. The next day, we finish up. You take notes, so you're making sure you get the names spelled correctly of the people you're interviewing and their jobs. And then you're putting that all in your folder, and you're flying. And then you're going back for the next assignment. Have you ever had to go back and realize, oh, geez, we never looked at the catapult arresting gear on the Texas Colt? We need to go back down there. Have you ever had to revisit a story before you leave?
No, I have not. That would be pretty embarrassing to have to do that, to be honest. But I certainly will always tell the manufacturer or the contact or whatever. I get their phone number and their ID their email, because I know that there are going to probably be questions I'm going to have that I just don't think about sometimes until I'm writing. And I am plunking away, and I go, and they use the, I just realized I never asked him what kind of system they used for the flight controls, or you know, how they connect this to that, and I go, ah, and I'll make myself a little list, because usually there are maybe two or three of those kinds of questions, and then I'll get that person back on the phone, and I'll just tell them, hey, I completely forgot to ask you about this thing, and they go, oh, yeah, sure, sure, and then they'll give me a little spiel, and I've got some more information, and sometimes it's worth asking if they have a picture of that thing when I hear how it was put together. But, you know, again, that's pretty common that you're going to call back. But revisit, that's probably okay. A no-no.
All right. Well, there you go, listeners. You now know what goes into writing the well-written stories you read in the pages of Flying Magazine. Rob, where else can we find you?
For years, I was where you are. I was an airplane geeks guy for, I don't know, ask Max a bunch.
You'll always be a geek to us.
Well, you know, and I remember back in the old days when being a geek was a bad thing. Now it's cool. So anyway, but also, you know, I still write Jetwine. Jetwine.com is the blog. And you'll see us at Jetwine on Instagram. And I don't know where else. Who knows? Who knows where you'll find me? I mean, I've been seen in many places unexpectedly.
Well, thank you, Rob. And listeners, there you go. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
All right. Thanks, Launchpad and Rob Mark, for that. I tell you, you know, Launchpad had me laughing when he asked Rob if he went in with a hypotenuse. When he really meant hypothesis. And then he did it again later, which was pretty amusing. And then we got to learn what Rob's ringtone is in the middle of that conversation.
His beloved TARDIS, huh?
That's right. It's doing the TARDIS
growling
sound.
Growling away.
So, yeah, thanks to both of you guys. That is really an interesting look at, you know, some of the things that we don't see when we read these articles. And don't see the other side of the coin. Max here, interrupting myself. This will just take a second. I forgot to mention something important. The article that Rob wrote that was the basis for the conversation you just heard with Launchpad is the cover story for the issue of Flying Magazine just out. I believe it's the May 2020 issue. So be sure to look for that. Okay, back to the show. Tom, you probably have similar kind of experiences as Rob, being in the creator standpoint as opposed to being on the consumer or the reader's standpoint. But there really is a lot of things that go into being an aviation journalist.
Yeah, you have to explain it to people, because if you talk to, especially when I was at Aerospace America, I was talking to engineers all the time who knew everything. They knew everything except how to explain it to people.
Yeah, and that's your job.
That's the case with a lot of people, honestly. I mean, because you spend all of your time researching. You know, you're not a public speaker. That's, you do what you're good at.
Right. Okay, a couple of shout-outs. First, of course, the Planes of Fame air show has been canceled for this year. That was originally planned for May 2nd and 3rd, 2020. And like many, many others, it's been canceled. The museum is temporarily closed. But you know what? They still have T-shirts that they had bought for the air show, and they're selling them cheap. So you can actually help them out if you'd like and buy the air show T-shirt for just $10. That's it, $10. They also have the long sleeve T-shirt for $14. And we'll have a link in the show notes where you can pick up some T-shirts. And then another item, you may be familiar with David Costa, also known as Renegade Aviator. And this is a guy that has pretty strong opinions. And he brings us the Renegade Aviator radio show, which is also actually published as a podcast that you can subscribe to. You can search for Renegade Aviator. And Aviator, of course, is A-V, the number 8, and an R, or whatever the appropriate, what's that, Alpha, Victor, Max T, help me out here. What's R? It's probably not
Romeo.
Rats. Romeo. Yeah.
See, I don't know this stuff. Well, anyway, David Costa, he promotes air shows. He promotes air show performers and flying history museums on his radio program. And he says that our air show industry is in danger of collapsing, and he wants to do something about it. So he'd like to see an expanded effort to promote all air show performers, air show events, and aviation history organizations. So, quoting him, he says, "We are contacting the aviation industry to join us in this mission. We all win when we all work together. The air show fans will come back, but we need to expand the audience. Our weekly radio show," he's talking about his own, "is already talking to the demographic, and they are hungry for the stories from the air show industry that we bring them. So the Renegade Aviator radio show will provide any air show performer, any air show event, and any aviation historical foundation the opportunity to tell their story on the radio show." He says, and there's no charge for this. So if you want to learn more, you can visit renegadeaviator.com, and we'll have that link in the show notes. Now, a little bit of interesting listener mail. David sent us a link to a video, and this is a video that's posted in the RAF Coningsby Spotters Group Facebook page, and it's called Stay at Home Air Show. And you really need to look at this and go to the show notes, airplanegeeks.com/599, because you've got to look at this video.
This is the best. It is the best. And anybody who grew up playing with toy airplanes, you know that you've wanted to do this.
There's little model airplanes and little model cars lined up in rows for the spectators at this air show. On the ground in someone's backyard, or maybe you call this the garden. And it features aerial teams. They're kind of connected together by a wire or something, and they've got.
They're flying. It's the Red Arrows.
It's the Red Arrows.
Flying in formation, a precision that you'd never seen anything like it.
No. And they've even got the smoke trails, which are accomplished by some. It looks like cotton trailing behind the little model airplanes. It's really creative. Go look at that. You really need to.
I must say, I've never seen anything like this before.
I know. It's really clever. This took a lot of work, too, to assemble all this. Yeah. And, you know, the performances, the air performances, he makes passes around the backyard and stuff. It's really pretty.
You know, it flies a DC-3 and, you know, a tornado demo. And, you know, it is decidedly English, but the backstory a little bit is there's a video before the one where it was a smaller video, and then the Sun decided they needed to grow it better. So it's one of the most fantastic pieces of video to come out of isolation and quarantine, and brings back that childhood spirit that you get. You know, yeah. I know that my Matchbox airplanes made air shows, you know, I mean, and that's what this is. It's just, it's simply beautiful, creative, and elegant in its simplicity.
And fun. I mean, that's
fun.
We heard from Ron. He said he's a longtime listener and aviation enthusiast. He said, but I have not heard any mention of the conversation Launchpad had flying his new plane, that was the Focke-Wulf, that made the short final segment. This was in AvWeb. I thought we mentioned this here, but maybe we didn't. Maybe it was just in the Slack team that it was circling around. But link to this in the show notes. This is also pretty entertaining. It's called Short Final Hostile Target, and it's on AvWeb, and it's an actual transcript of communication between Launchpad flying his Focke-Wulf in and air traffic control and at least one other pilot. So it's pretty amusing. Look for that in the show notes. And then, you know, we have a lot of humorous and entertaining feedback this episode, it seems. Anne wrote to us. She said, "This is a story your audience may find jaw-dropping. I don't know if the word luck applies here or not." And this is an article in Aviation Week by Steve Trimble. Raphael ride leads to inadvertent ejection by overstressed passenger. So This goes to, I guess some folks wanted to surprise another guy, a 64-year-old contractor, with a ride in a jet. So they didn't tell him about it. They organized this. They made all the arrangements, and they didn't tell him till basically the last minute. So he had no time to become accustomed to the idea of this jet ride that he was going to take. So he was the backseat passenger, of course, and
he got nervous and pulled the plug.
That's what happened. Yeah,
I mean, he inadvertently ejected and left the aircraft while the aircraft was still flying.
That's right. That's right. So in the pre-flight, the medical, the doctor had limited him to a maximum of 3 Gs, but that doctor's guidance wasn't relayed to either this passenger or the pilot of the Rafael. So the thing went up, climb after takeoff, greater than 4.5 Gs. And it says that perhaps due to the stress, the passenger failed to properly buckle in. The backside of his shoulder strap allowed more motion than necessary. In addition, he didn't fasten the right leg of his pressure suit, lower the helmet visor, or snap the chin strap of his helmet. How many things are wrong here? And then it says, this is the best line of the whole story, the passenger's experience in the backseat of the Rafael would be brief.
Rafale.
Sorry. Yes.
Rafale, not Rafael. That's an artist. Rafale is an airplane.
I know that. So pilot rotated on takeoff, got up to 4.5 Gs. It says within about 10 seconds of rotation, pilot leveled off quickly, causing the loads to invert to negative 0.63 Gs. The shocked passenger, whose loose shoulder straps may have allowed him to start floating upward, reached for a handle, which happened to be the mechanism that causes his seat to eject. So it says, because the passenger had failed to lower his visor and fasten his chin strap, the exposure to the 200-knot airflow outside the aircraft caused his helmet to fly off. Besides minor injuries to his face, the passenger landed safely by the runway after his parachute opened at around 2,000 feet. Now, the interesting thing is that there's a switch in the cockpit where the pilot can determine or specify what happens when someone ejects. It could be either if the passenger ejects, that both the pilot's ejection seat and the passenger's ejection seat goes off, or just the passenger's. And it was set to eject both. Someone ejects, they both go out. But fortunately, it malfunctioned, so the pilot's ejection seat didn't activate, and he was able to land the plane. Of course, it had no canopy at that point, but he was able to land the plane. Crazy story. It comes from the report. It actually happened about a year ago, but this is the final report from this. So the facts ought to be straight. Besides, Steve Trimble wouldn't lead us astray, not in Aviation Week anyway.
Boy, it sounds like a bad day for everyone involved.
Yeah, that's just too much. All right, so as David said at the start, this was going to be a long episode, and it turns out that it was. So since you're most likely passing the time at home, also known as working from home, maybe this was something to keep you occupied and entertained a little bit along the way. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Tom Risen, space and aviation reporter out of Washington, D.C. Appreciate having you on the show, Tom.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
You can find us at airplanegeeks.com to go right to the show notes for all the great stuff that are in there this episode, especially visit airplanegeeks.com/599. If you want to reach us by email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Well, David Vanderhoof, how do they find more of you?
They can find me on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on our Slack listener team. And of course, that's growing by leaps and bounds with everybody being home. But you can do that by sending us an email to feedback.
That's the other show. But you know what? They both go to the same place.
You can send us a link to
no, not a link, an email.
Okay, let's try this one more time. You can send us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you a link, and you can join the gang on our Slack listener teams. And of course, now if you join, you'll have the opportunity to pick the world's worst aviation movie, at least as far as the Slack listener team goes. So there's another incentive to join the club. And of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about UASs on the UAV Digest.
All right. And Max Truscott, how about you?
Well, I want to ask everyone who's listening and also has a Facebook account to go out to my new Facebook page that I just put up a week or so ago for the Aviation News Talk podcast. And when you go out there, you'll be able to see what is probably one of my favorite pictures I've ever taken across the top of the page there. So just go out to facebook.com/aviationnewstalk. And if you want, you can also send me a message while you're on that page. And go ahead, like the page, please.
All right. Tom, do you have any social media destinations that you'd like people to visit?
Yes, please. Just follow me at Tom Risen on Twitter. It's just my name. I got to Twitter pretty early.
Yes, so. Very good. And Risen is R-I-S-E-N, Tom Risen.
Yes, thank you.
And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight, on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, and over at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience. So please join us again next week for our 600th episode, if you can believe that. I barely can, as we talk about aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Stay home and stay healthy.
Keep the blue side up. And thanks for listening.